From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our series that explores how different religious traditions explain evil in the world. It was the shooting at the elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut that got us thinking about the series. And this question, if there is a God, where was he or she when Adam Lanza started shooting? Well, what if the answer was God wasn't really paying attention or God was out of town? It's not terribly satisfying as an answer. It's even kind of blasphemous for some. But for the ancient Greeks, this was how the world worked. The scholar Mary Lefkowitz is joining us today as we talk about tragedy and the Greek gods. Lefkowitz says the gods helped ancient people understand and come to terms with the world around them because they didn't really care about humans. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're getting back to our series called Why. Why would God, if there is a God, allow suffering in the world? And we've asked the question to various people of various religious philosophies, Jewish, evangelical, Mormon. We've had an atheist on to offer perspective. But today we're going to try and get at this question by altering the premise of God that's held by most, that God is or is not an all-present, all-knowing being who is fundamentally good. The scholar Mary Lefkowitz is our guest today to talk about tragedy and the Greek gods. Lefkowitz doesn't see the Greek myths as frivolous, but as an important way of understanding how the Greeks understood the world around them. And this works for our purposes because the gods helped the Greeks understand the limitations of the human condition. There was no idea of redemption in some afterlife. There was no promise of a reward or even a happy life. So tragedy was just part of it. We invite you to join the conversation today. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Mary Lefkowitz is a professor emerita of classical studies at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. She's the author of a number of books, among them Greek Gods, Human Lives. And she's joining us today from a studio on the Wellesley campus. And Professor Lefkowitz, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
Well, I guess I want to start with this idea of that we have to sort of change the concept here. We have to alter our assumptions and our perceptions of the world. And I wanted to know, first of all, from you, was this difficult for you to sort of get your head around the way the Greeks perceived of the world?
Oh, I think it was very difficult for me to get my head around the way the Greeks perceived the world because it is so different from the way we're brought up, even if we're brought up essentially as non-believers. All around us is the notion that God cares for us. And the people associated with God, the Virgin Mary, Jesus care for us, the saints care for us. That just simply isn't part of it.
Let me ask you about Greek tragedy, the story of King Oedipus, for example, who, for all of those who may need a refresher, unwittingly kills his father, marries his mother, then gouges out his eyes. But Oedipus doesn't deserve this. It's something that just happened to him. Does this kind of illustrate the worldview?
To some extent, it does, but it isn't that it just happened to him, at least the way Sophocles tells the story. It's that it's an inherited problem in the family. He's being punished for something that both his father did, which was disobeying the god and the oracle, even to have a son, and then his grandfather did. So it goes back. And he was given the prophecy that he would kill his father and marry his mother, yeah. And he hoped he could beat that out by leaving the people he thought were his father and mother, who were the king and queen of Corinth, but they were only his adoptive parents. He didn't know that. And so he, by trying to get away from the problem, he ended up fulfilling the oracle. So in a way, he's punished way beyond anything he might have tried to do. He didn't want to do those things. Mm.
Even though the stories in Greek myths are sometimes entertaining, you say, and I think this is pretty important to you, that they're not frivolous. You say that if we see the Greek belief system of the gods as frivolous, that we're doing them an injustice. What do you mean?
Well, we all, or at least we used to, people do learn myths in school, and they think, well, they're nice little stories, and the gods each have their own little bailiwick. You know, Aphrodite is the goddess of love, and Athena is the goddess of intelligence, and so on. And all that's very simplified and made into pleasant stories like fairy tales. And for the ancient Greeks, I think these stories were meant to help you understand life in many, many different aspects. And that's why when I taught mythology anyway, I always asked my students to read ancient sources in English translation, of course. Mm. And rather than summaries of myths or modern summaries of myths, because when we retell the stories, we're always putting ourselves into it, no matter how hard we try not to.
Yeah. You write in your book that most treatments of myths, for example, and the role of the gods in them is misrepresented. And you even make a reference in your book to Joseph Campbell, who did a lot for myths, obviously, but he also said that all myths had universal truths, that they kind of conveyed the same kinds of messages. But you dispute that. You say that's not really the way to look at myths.
Well, to a point, I agree with him. That is, myths should be taken very seriously, and they do tell you something that you need to know. But I don't think they all add up to deal with the same problems or mean the same things. It's very hard for me to generalize because I don't know all mythologies all over the world. Mm-hmm. But I think Campbell, to a great degree, homogenized everything, and he rather made fun of the Greek gods. He say you could compare Mount Olympus to Capitol Hill or something like that. You know, just kind of made fun of it. And you can look at it that way, but to me that's going in the wrong direction.
Yeah. So the ancient Greeks, they didn't have a sacred text like the Bible. So do we have a sense of how myths began in some way? I know they were passed along in poetry form, but do we have a sense of their origin in any way?
Well, many people will tell you what happened, but I don't think anybody knows.
Yeah.
Because we weren't there, and the only way we can know anything about the remote past is by a written record. The civilizations we know most about are the ones whose writing we can read. That would, of course, include the ancient Greeks and the ancient Egyptians and so on. But we just don't know. Certainly, the way the Homeric poems were composed suggests that there was a tradition of reciting poetry without a text, orally. But how exactly poets worked and whether one person wrote down the Iliad, because it's much longer than any other orally composed poem, and the Odyssey is too. Mm. I just can't tell you. People will tell you, but I'm not one of them.
Yeah. Did the Greeks believe, so I want to get a sense of how they saw the gods, what the kind of the purpose for the gods were. Did they believe that the gods had created humankind?
Well, there are a variety of beliefs about how humankind got there. It seems sometimes that Zeus put the present generation on Earth, at other times that a god called Prometheus did. Mm-hmm. So there are various stories. But whatever it was, the gods didn't seem very happy with human beings, except when a particularly attractive one, male or female, came along, and that was sexually appealing to them. But other than that, it wasn't like the beginning of the book of Genesis, mm-hmm. where there is a beneficent God is connected with providence in the sense that he wants to do something kind for mankind, and it's mankind's fault, humankind's fault, I should say, that people get into trouble.
Yeah. You say that it's important to note that the Greek gods weren't, you know, just representations of things, that they were independent beings with these powers, and they controlled the world. They controlled everything in the world. So for the Greeks, how did they explain the gods' purpose? I mean, if they weren't there to protect them or care for them, did they explain them other than just the fact that they were there, that they did exist?
I think that's the answer. They did exist. They were there. They lived to please themselves. They lived, as Homer says, at their ease. They spent time feasting and enjoying themselves. I think they looked at human life largely as we might look at television, that it was something to amuse them in their endless days of immortality, that getting involved in affairs on Earth was of interest to them. And they did want a kind of general justice to be done. But they did interfere in human life sometimes, and other times they seem indifferent to it. And it's a worldview that is, as I said, so very different from that of the Old Testament.
Mm. So there is a hierarchy, of course, in order to all of this in the gods. Zeus is the ruler of the gods. He comes to this power by deposing his father, if I understand that right. So how does it work? I mean, what's the kind of the power grid there? It starts with Zeus?
Well, it goes back further than that, and it's a little vague. Earth seems to come out of the great void that is chaos, called chaos. It's just essentially nothing. And she gives birth to heaven, and heaven, and she then have a number of children, but he doesn't want any of them to take power. So in the end, he's overthrown by his son, his youngest son, Cronos, who is Zeus's father. And in turn, Cronos knows that his son will be stronger than he. So he starts to eat all his children. And then Zeus's mother hides him away. And so when Zeus grows up very quickly, he comes back and takes over from his father. Now, the difference between Zeus and his father is that Zeus knows this will happen to him, and he plans ahead. And he is the first god who really uses intelligence. And he also is the first god who shares his power with other gods, who gives other gods positions of importance in the world. So you get not a tyranny, but a kind of constitutional monarchy where other gods can challenge Zeus on things and not be punished.
I want to come back to this a little bit later in the program because I think this is an important point, this idea of inquiry and discussion, persuasion being an important part of all of this. But let me ask you, for the Greeks, did they believe Zeus was all-powerful?
Well, he was as powerful as any god could get, but no god seems to be all-powerful, and you need a bunch of gods to fight against other gods who want to take over from them or other forces. So it's not the notion of an absolutely all-powerful deity such as the god of the Old Testament.
The gods, they know, as you said, they know of the humans. But they don't feel like it's their responsibility to take care of them, right? Or to provide them with things? What is the relationship? How did the gods see the humans? You said they were kind of annoyed by them most of the time.
Well, they're annoyed by human bad behavior, certainly. Huh. And they feel that humans pay little attention to justice and are too contentious and too evil. That's why at one point Zeus sends a flood that wipes out mankind. We, of course, we know the same flood story from the Old Testament. But then the world is repopulated, and things start going bad again. It seems to be in the nature of the human experience to do things foolishly.
What was the point of worshiping the gods? And did they pray to them? I mean, if they could be capricious, these gods, for sure. So what was the point of asking for things? You just sort of hoped you would get a response?
Well, gods like honor. And if you honor them by asking them and praying to them and addressing them, and prayer was not something you did in private. You did it in public where people could see you. You raised your arms up to the sky. And it was, and you offered sacrifices. You offered them things that the gods you thought an honor that they might like to have. I think that's how you appeal to them. And yes, I think you believe in these gods and their existence because they are powerful. They represent all the forces that are coming at us from all directions in the world. You know, think back to the time when you don't know the cause of diseases. You don't know the cause of the weather. Science is at a very, very primitive state. So how do you explain things? Well, it is all these entities that control these things. And if you pray to the winds for a prosperous voyage, or pray to Apollo to tell you what the future will be, you might have a slightly better chance.
You mentioned that in your book that a sacrifice for an ancient family could be a pretty big risk. Let's say you had one cow and you sacrificed this to the gods. There wasn't any guarantee, I guess.
No, you don't know. But gods like honor. So if you take something very valuable, it's sort of like driving your car off a cliff, saying, okay, well, God wants this car, so I'll let him have it. And then you don't have it, so that means it's a sacrifice.
Yeah. Could you blaspheme against, was that an idea that they held, that I'm wondering if this was a concept of monotheism, but, could the idea of cursing God or questioning God, was there blasphemy in that?
You could certainly question God. That was not blasphemous. You could say, Zeus, why did you do this to me? Or Apollo, why? I offered all these sacrifices at your oracle at Delphi. Why then have you treated me this way? You can certainly ask that question, but you can't really say, well, the gods do not exist, or talk about having a private god of your own. That's Socrates seemed to do that, and I think those are things that people objected to.
Yeah, but you write about the fact that the ancient Greeks and the Romans were respectful and accepting of other gods, but they didn't approve of the idea of non-belief. Atheism, for example, they wouldn't have approved of that.
No, of someone who said there were no gods, and because that would have implied that he thought there was no order in the world and no principles of justice. I think they disapproved of monotheism because it was so exclusive. And you see in the lives of the saints, you see these Roman officials saying, well, look, just offer a pinch of incense to the deified emperor and you can get out of here. We don't want to kill you.
Yeah.
And the people, the martyrs, pre-martyrs, would say, no, I can't do that. There is one God who created heaven and earth. And that the Romans just couldn't understand that.
Yeah. You mentioned Socrates. He didn't believe in the gods that the rest of the Athenians believed in some ways. He, as you say, he had this kind of... Go ahead.
Well, no, I think he did. I think he just felt that he had some private communication, a thing that he called the little divine thing, the daimonion,
right,
that spoke to him. And but no one else heard it, and they thought that was very odd. Athenians did.
Right. You said that kind of went against the Athenian idea of religion, which was what?
That it was
open. It was public.
Right. And that if an oracle was given at Delphi, many people heard it. People knew about it. It was a public thing. And people didn't have private oracles and private voices speaking to them. I think Socrates also said that gods could do no wrong, that God must be good, and the things that go wrong come from some other cause. And I think that's another problem, because that would be a kind of blasphemy, too, to think that gods are connected only with providence.
Mary Lefkowitz is joining us, a scholar of classical studies and the author of Greek Gods, Human Lives, What We Can Learn from Myths. You can join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're getting back to our series called Why. We've been exploring how different religious traditions explain or account for evil in the world. It's tough to do if you believe in an all-knowing God who is always good, but what if God or gods aren't so good? We're talking about the gods, plural, today with the scholar Mary Lefkowitz. She's the author of the book Greek Gods, Human Lives. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So, Mary Lefkowitz, if you're okay, as the Greeks were, with this idea that other people worship other gods, that your gods didn't have all of the answers, then it seems to give you a fairly open mind about the world. This seemed a characteristic for the Greeks. They were pretty open.
It's certainly very different from the traditions of monotheism, all of which are fighting with each other in many ways, and even within a certain strand of religion, there are many sects fighting against each other over details. That just was not really something that affected the ancient world. The Greeks would arrive in Egypt and see that these were a people who worshiped gods, and they were very respectful about it and associated some of their gods with the Egyptian gods, and vice versa.
So there were
some things they disagreed about,
of course,
I should say, too.
But there didn't necessarily need to be a competition, I guess, over whose god was the right god. They figured everyone believed in these different kinds of gods, and in some cases that was okay, I guess. Is that fair to say?
Yes. In most cases it was okay, particularly if they saw that these were people who believed in gods. That's what they thought was very important.
You've written about this. There's this, of course, this ongoing dispute about religion, where you have those who say, you know, religion poisons everything. And you've written about that. You say the problem isn't necessarily religion, it's monotheism. Say something about that, if you would.
Well, monotheism seems to be more intolerant. It says, well, there is one way to do things. There is one God. And if you believe something else, you're wrong. And this, I think we can see that acted out still in the world today in some strands of monotheistic religions and different sects of Christianity battling with each other. And certainly that's true also in Islam and even in Judaism, between the people who are more secular and the people who are more observant. So I think that the Greeks, certainly in their form of polytheism, were much more open-minded, and it's a better explanation of the presence of evil in the world than much of what we have today.
Mm. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones. Jonathan is with us in Bountiful. Jonathan, welcome.
My question is how the Eleusinian mysteries affected the ancient Greeks' concept of good and evil, and I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Professor, did you get that question?
I did, and I think it's a wonderful question. I wish I could answer it better. I think the Eleusinian mysteries are still pretty mysterious to us, what they did, but it meant whatever it was, I think it had some connection with looking at what happened in life after death and getting a better place in the world of the dead. It also certainly had something to do with your conduct in the world and trying to be more just. The religion in general would argue for that, but clearly it meant a lot to do whatever it was that happened at Eleusis to an awful lot of people. And right from the very beginning of our records, right through Roman times, I wish I could answer the question. I think there are a lot of speculation about it, but that would be my guess.
Mm. Jonathan, thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST, again, the number two. Join the conversation. So Zeus has this power, and he has this great intelligence, and you say that he wasn't this tyrant, this autocratic ruler. He gives rights and privileges to other gods, and he could be persuaded, you say, by other gods. I mean, this seems an important aspect of the story, being open to inquiry and discussion. It's an important feature of Greek theology.
Yes, and I think that may spread down to the world of human beings, where extreme tyranny is very suspect. You want a ruler to listen to advice and to consult with people, and I think that that's something certainly that comes up in tragedy as an issue. You want that kind of discussion, and female gods, goddesses, could raise some of the questions. Hera does that when Zeus wants to save his son Sarpedon in the Iliad from being killed by Patroclus. Hera says, well, you can't do that. Then everyone else would do it too. So all he can do is to try and honor Sarpedon and his son by having Sleep and Death carry him back to Lycia, his homeland. That kind of argument, I can't imagine anything like it taking place in the Old Testament.
Yeah. So another thing you've written about is that you have the God of the Old Testament, for example. He was a man. He was a God of one people. Whereas the Greek gods, and I guess even the Roman gods, they were, you've used this term, more multicultural, I guess.
Yes, you could add gods if you thought another god and from another country. For instance, Cybele from Asia Minor, a goddess who wasn't indigenous to the Greek mainland, could be worshipped, and you could add other gods as well, and that became even more popular as time went on. You get Mithras and the worship of Isis, the Egyptian goddess, coming into all of Greece and Rome in Hellenistic times. So that's from the second century BC on into the early centuries of the Common Era. So it's definitely something, it's quite different. And goddesses, too, have a role. Goddesses can be seen to be very powerful. Isis would certainly be an example. Athena, who is the daughter of Zeus, very powerful also. That they are worshipped by men as well as by women.
Mm. So the idea we've been trying to get at with this series is how these, you know, various religious traditions explain or account for evil in the world, how that, you know, works alongside the idea of a loving God. So having more than one God, what kind of understanding does that offer for the Greeks about the presence of evil and of the fact of suffering in the world?
Well, you can have a God who is for you, but who can do nothing if another God is against you. And so you can enjoy the company or even support of one particular god. But if another god is angry at you for some reason, which may have very little or nothing to do with anything you did, then you can be punished by that god, and the other god will not stop it. So this explains why things can go as terribly wrong as they often do, and why good people are swept up along with the people who have perpetrated the wrongs that are done. You get that right at the very beginning of the Iliad, where Agamemnon offends the priests of Apollo. Apollo doesn't kill Agamemnon. He starts killing the ordinary soldiers and animals, animals who did nothing to anybody at all. Mm. So that is the beginning of the Iliad tells you a lot about the way the Greeks looked at the world, which is some particular god can get furious, and he can punish an important person by attacking that person's property or allies or whatever.
I wanted to, you know, there's that, people are maybe familiar with the line from the Aeschylus play. I want to read it and get your take on it. And people have heard this. Robert F. Kennedy famously has used it
time
after his brother was killed. He who learns must suffer. And even in our sleep, pain that cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart. And in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom to us by the awful grace of God. How are you explaining that? How do you see that in the context of the conversation we're having today?
Well, that is a famous passage from Aeschylus's play Agamemnon.
Yeah.
And it occurs in the context of a choral passage where the chorus, who were old men of Argos, which is where the home of Agamemnon is before he returns home to be murdered, they are talking about the Trojan War and the sufferings not only to the Trojans, but to the Greeks themselves who were fighting against the Trojans as the cause of that war. And that is their explanation of what this experience must mean, that you learn through suffering. And tragedy is really all about that, except you learn vicariously. It's somebody else's suffering.
Yeah.
But your life will have plenty of suffering of its own, is the covert message,
right.
I believe.
You say even for the gods, justice, there is a sense of justice for the gods, but it would be done, you know, it would be done in the end, but it would happen on their timetable because they're really, they've got the good life and they're not really in any kind of hurry.
No, well, if you're immortal, you know, time can take a very long time to go by. I mean, they just, our human lives are, they call them creatures of a day. Human beings live no time at all. Everything goes fast for us. So they're on a different timetable. They get around to it eventually. We may never know about it.
Here's a question from Susan, who writes, was there a gender difference amongst the gods in relation to their compassion or their lack of compassion? Could you, for example, count on a goddess being quicker to help than a god?
That's a wonderful question. And I think the answer is not necessarily. I think goddesses are unlike human women. They're tremendously powerful, and they can have a child, but they recover, and as I feel towards the end of my life, they don't grow old. They're always beautiful. They're always young. So they lack that compassion, too. There's a wonderful scene at the end of Euripides' Hippolytus where Artemis, who's protected Hippolytus but can't save him from the wrath of Aphrodite, whom he's offended, comes and said, well, I'm very sorry that, you know, you're dying now, and I can't really help you. And in fact, I can't stick around because it's not really right for me to see dead people. So farewell. And there he is. And he said, well, you leave this long relationship. It's long to him, very lightly. But their conversations were just things of a moment to her, to Artemis, not particularly compassionate.
Susan, thanks. You write in your book that if human characters in the myths express questions about the intentions of the gods, a lot of the times it's because they don't really appreciate or don't want to anyway understand how different the gods are from themselves. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think if gods take a human form, they're anthropomorphic, you may occasionally forget, particularly when they appear to you, they appear as other human beings, you may forget that they aren't like human beings, only briefly in appearance, and usually they, to themselves, they would appear different. Differently from the way they appear to us. So I think that they, because they're immortal, they can have no tragedy. They can only, if they get into a battle, they can't kill each other. What defines human life is tragedy, is a tragic loss and death. And without that, the gods really lack that level of compassion and involvement with us.
Mary Lefkowitz is with us. Her book is called Greek Gods, Human Lives, and we invite you to join us. Again, with questions or comments, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the scholar Mary Lefkowitz. We're talking about, well, we're continuing our series on the question of why, how different religious traditions explain or account for evil in the world. And we're talking with Professor Lefkowitz about the Greek gods. She has a book called Greek Gods, Human Lives, What We Can Learn from Myths. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. One of the interesting things about this story, it seems, is that it sort of turns around the idea of who gets the blame. With monotheism, you say that, you know, God is always good and omnipresent, so the mortals have to take the blame if something goes wrong. But when you have a collection of gods, I guess, who may control the world, but also happen to be, you know, capricious and self-indulgent and petty. Humans don't have to always be at fault. Talk about that part.
Well, I think it takes some of the burden, obviously, off the human beings. You may be at fault, or you may not be. You may be paying for somebody else's fault, or just be caught in the middle of a clash between different gods. So I think it does relieve us of some sense of guilt and responsibility. And the idea that a being could come along and take away all the sins of the world would be very, very foreign to them, I think. And you can see that's one of the reasons why Christianity had some great appeal, that somehow one could be forgiven, whereas in Greek religion, you make a mistake, well, that's it.
Let's go back to the phones. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. John is with us in West Haven, Utah. John, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Appreciate you taking my call. I honestly didn't catch all your conversation. I'm wondering if there's a, shall we say, a god of stupidity, because you can't blame a god, any of the gods, on every single thing that happens to you. You know, if something goes wrong, they can't say, well, that must have been Zeus did that to me, or, you know, I mean, don't they allow for accidents or stupidity?
That's the point,
right? Oh, for sure.
Yeah,
oh, sure. You can, there's a double level of causation. Human beings can mess up big time, and in fact, a lot of tragedy is concerned with human ignorance. The gods make things very clear in many ways to human beings, and human beings do not see it. They misinterpret the oracles. They misinterpret dreams that the gods sent to them that might help explain what to do in the future. They also willfully do things wrong. So there's tremendous culpability on the part of human beings, and human beings are very much responsible for what happens to them. But gods can be responsible too. There's a lot of blame.
John, thanks very much. I wanted to get a sense of just how, when monotheism emerges as an idea, as a belief system, how strange was it? How innovative was it? Well, let's start with strange. For the Greeks, for example, who believed in something more fluid and more, you know, a universe that was more packed with gods.
I think it must have seemed extremely strange. There's not a tremendous amount of information about how individuals felt about that, because a lot of that literature clearly disappeared or was lost in Christian times. But clearly, Christianity had a great appeal because it had answers where Greek, and sort of comforting answers where Greek religion offered none. But the idea of just one single divinity who is responsible for the things, and that there was hope at the end, that you could die but be reborn, that your life had some purpose and some meaning except for the subject of a song, that I think must have helped the spread of Christianity. There are many other things that went into it as well, such as that Christianity was, as it developed, became better and better organized and did more things on the ground for people, offered them more services than the very disorganized and confused setup of paganism.
You've written about this pagan named Celsus, who wrote this treatise attacking Jewish and Christian beliefs. Talk about Celsus, because Celsus found the idea of faith, this concept of faith, kind of what confusing, I guess.
Well, the idea that you would just believe in something that you could never have seen demonstrated to you would seem rather odd to someone raised as he was. Now, it's hard to know exactly what Celsus thought, because we only know what he said because he's quoted by a Christian writer. We don't have his own treatise intact. But many things about Christianity struck him as extremely strange. One was that the gods should care about poor, insignificant people. Because when you look at great works of Greek literature, it's rather elitist stuff. It's kings and rulers and royal families so much. of the time, all through Greek tragedy, that the small people appear only, mainly very sensibly, to say, well, I'm getting out of here before things get worse. But that is something that he brings up as well. Mm. I think he found it very odd. And I wish we knew what some earlier people thought and Greek people thought, but I don't know.
Yeah. Here's an email from Jay, who writes from Salt Lake City. Does the Greek belief in multiple gods and their capriciousness stem from their agrarian lives? Nature, he writes, is a fickle and uncaring thing. It strikes you down whether you're a good person or a bad person. Seems like the Greek gods, he says, behave much like nature. They do what they want, when they want, and they will inevitably outlast humanity and our petty human endeavors.
I think it's a great point. I think that probably did contribute to it, I mean, as much as we can tell, because Zeus is, after all, a sky god. He brings the rain, or if he's in a bad mood, he doesn't bring the rain, and then your crop suffers, particularly in an increasingly arid climate like that of Greece. So I think that could well have been a contributing factor. But basically, it's that there was no scientific explanation for a lot of things. You know, the diseases, the idea that the god Zeus particularly was angry at Prometheus and sent this woman with a jar full of evils, and all the diseases get out. She takes the lid off the jar, and all the diseases come out through the world and can attack human beings by day and by night, and there's no cure for any of them.
Mm.
The Pandora myth.
Right. So as the Greeks saw it, there's no redemption, really. There's no promise of a happy life. There's no sense of a reward in an afterlife. So they just kind of have to accept the reality of human existence. And I wonder, do we get a sense in any of the writing, in any of the plays, for example, or any of what you've been able to discover, do you think life for the ancient Greeks was... It could be bleak, you could say, on one hand, but on the other hand, you could say it, maybe their lives had less stress, that in some way maybe they were happier because they were unburdened with a sense of guilt or fear of reprisal. Well, I guess there could be a fear of reprisal, but do you get a sense that there was that their lives, if they had this, if they just saw life as it was, that in some way that made life more easier in some way to live, in some way?
I wish I could answer that. I know that it seems to me the Greek way of looking at things, to the extent that I understand it, has been very helpful to me in my life. It's helped me to understand how I feel when members of my family died, and to look at death and to all the things that one goes through in one's life and seeing the terrible things that happen in the world. It does help one to understand that without being totally angry, because you realize that this is the nature of human existence, that it is essentially tragic because we die, because we can't fulfill all our ambitions, and because we are so fallible that we make these terrible mistakes like going to war to try and solve problems. So I think it's very helpful, and I have found Greek tragedy with some of the speeches and some of the things which I've taught many times and learned by heart almost to be very helpful in these moments of despair.
Let's go back to the phone. 801-585-WEST is the number. Delos is with us in Layton, Utah. Delos, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I just wanted, I guess, to take a little exception to the discussion about the difference between Christianity and Greek religion, and would reference back to the mention made of the play Hippolytus, which is like almost, and I would even go to say every Greek tragedy, which is, of course, a type of the death of Jesus. And it is true that Artemis left Hippolytus to die, but as I read the Bible, the father left the son to die on his own, and his words, last words were, "Why have thou forsaken me?" But Hippolytus' last words were not to the goddess. They were to his sin-stained father, Theseus, who was caught up in the terrible blood grudge of the Furies. And Hippolytus said to him, "I will die for you." And Hippolytus took on himself the sins of his father, and that is the miracle which the Greeks understood. And that is the miracle represented by every tragic hero, from Prometheus, who was an immortal god who suffered for man's reason, right on down through Heracles and to Achilles, who died to preserve justice. And so I don't see any separation between the truths of Christianity and the doctrines of Christianity, which is no more of a foreign religion influenced by the Greeks than the cult of Isis or Mithras. They're all Greek-influenced. Anyway, those are my thoughts.
Yeah. Professor, what do you think? You've heard that before, I'm sure.
Well, not quite as forcefully stated. I think that I see that as being somewhat Christianized, everything. The way I read the end of the Hippolytus is that Hippolytus, Theseus is certainly wrong, but the concept of sin doesn't, in the modern sense of the world, really doesn't enter in there. The Greeks would say he made, and Artemis says, you fool, you made a big mistake. You took one of the curses you had and used it against your son, and you shouldn't have done that. He's made a huge mistake. Hippolytus forgives him, but he is not redeemed in any way with an immortal life or anything like that. There is a cult that will be named after him. I think that Achilles doesn't really die to preserve justice. He is very, the Iliad talks about his anger, and he's certainly angry at Agamemnon, and he's very angry at himself that Patroclus died, which he feels is his fault. But he doesn't redeem anybody through that. I think that's Christianizing it. And if you read the texts as they're written, not as you reinterpret them and internalize them, that's the way you'll come out.
Talas, thanks. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. You said that if things did go wrong for the ancient Greeks, that humans had to, seek comfort not from the gods, but they had to seek comfort from each other, from other humans. This seems like an important kind of concept. They had to turn to each other, not someone else.
Yes, I think that's one of the most important lessons that tragedy teaches, that Dionysus in Euripides' drama The Bacchae is angry at his family, his human family. He's half human himself, but made a god by Zeus, his father. He's very angry at them and punishes them horribly. And at the end of the play, Cadmus, his grandfather, says to him, "Why have you punished us so much?" And Dionysus answers, "I am a god, and you didn't honor me sufficiently, and all these things have been decided long ago. You go into exile, your wife into exile. Everything you built up, you will lose. Everyone has to leave." And he leaves himself. And the human beings have a brief moment to comfort each other before they have to go. The human beings are the ones who express compassion, not the god.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think the gods, this concept of the Greek gods, didn't persist as a belief system? I mean, I think there are those who would say that, one omnipotent God with supernatural powers isn't all that more implausible than a collection of capricious, conniving gods. But we've come to a point where we talk about the Greek gods as a kind of ancient relic of a time. Why didn't they persist as an idea?
Well, that's so hard to know because people don't really write down enough about why they discarded the old religion for newer religions. I think Christianity took over and became much more institutionalized, not only after the Roman Empire, but certainly after Constantine converted. I think all that, as a bureaucracy, was much more successful. And it offers people something that the Greek version of paganism does not, which is hope of redemption and of a future and of a life after death. So I think those are all reasons why we can't revive that kind of religion. Also, science, our knowledge and understanding of the way the forces in the world work make it very much harder to accept the notion that there's the God of the east wind and the north wind and so on.
Yeah, yeah. You've also said it's the ultimate realism that made people abandon traditional mythology. You know, that it was hard to deal with that kind of reality, I guess.
Oh, I think Christianity offers you a set of beliefs that is very comforting and reassuring. And the reality put out in Greek tragedy is very, very hard to accept. You know, the unreasoning death, the cruelty, the suffering is all without redemption. It's a very brutal worldview. I think it's very accurate. You know, you were talking at the beginning of the show about things like Newtown, Connecticut, and some of the many, if it were only an isolated tragedy, but there's so many other senseless acts of horrible violence within the context of war and without. How can we explain those things? I think Greek religion would say, this is in the nature of things, that life is hard and there isn't much relief from it. And in a way, understanding that can help you get through the next day.
Mary Lefkowitz, her book is called Greek Gods, Human Lives, What We Can Learn from Myths. Joined us from a studio on the Wellesley campus there. And Professor, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Susan Anderson and to Taylor Almond. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.